And it means essentially, I think it's something like 6 o'clock start, something. Quite late, but it's not super late. It's going to be super boring because I'll be locked in a hotel room for like 21 days.
21 days of quarantine.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's not messing around, mate. You literally can't leave the room. No cleaning, nothing above with that. It's like deliver food at your door. That is it.
What are you going to do for 21 days in a hotel room?
I have no idea. I want to do a lot of brain food is the bottom line. So there's going to be this. I'm going to bring my Oculus. So I'll watch all the Netflix I can watch. And I'm going to do something ridiculous. Like maybe set a 1,000 press up a day challenge or something, you know, like prison fitness style thing. Cause I'll have loads of time. There's no doubt I'll have loads of time.
There's a couple of good apps that are like, here's exercise that you can do without weights.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I don't even know where there's any floor space. This is a Hong Kong hotel, by the way. So those places are tiny in terms of, you know, what you're going to get. I didn't go to cheapest. I went like mid-range, but I still feel it's going to be a very, very small space. And we'll see how we go on with that. Anyway, folks, just talking about my forthcoming trip to Hong Kong. I think, fingers crossed, I'll be on a flight tomorrow. I've just got to print out a lot of stuff. Got my negative PCR test yesterday, so COVID-free. And if I can get my kind of crap together, I should be able to get on that flight and get over there. So that will be all good. Okay, so we're live, everybody. So welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 109. I'm bringing it to you every Friday, as we always do. And by the way, even though I'm going to be in the opposite side of the world for the next 3 weeks after this, Brain Food continues as is. So make sure you follow the channel if you like this kind of chat. Okay, we've got a super exciting show for you today because this is a topic that is really close to my heart. And if you're in recruitment, I reckon it's got to be close to your heart as well, because we're talking about a journey I think most of us have made, or the ones that have moved in-house have made this journey. We're talking about starting off your career as a recruitment agent and then progressing in various reasons. You might find yourself with an opportunity or a desire to move corporate side. And that's a journey I've made, and I want to talk about that. What is that journey? What are the challenges? Why is it different? What are the different pressures? What do you need to know if you want to make that move? Because one of the questions I've been feeling quite a lot is I'm sensing a lot of frustration from a lot of recruiters out there, agency recruiters out there that want to try this way of working, but they're struggling to get in for one reason or another. And I want to try and explore what exactly recruiters of agency recruiters into in-house, what do they think when they're analyzing a candidate? You know, what is it about your background, your demeanor, your skill set that is attractive where they can see, look, there's potential in this person to do it? And, you know, so that's what we're going to explore today. So super interesting. Make sure you follow along. Okay, let's talk about a quick shout out to our sponsors. As ever, we are delighted to be sponsored by our friends at Occupop. They are one of the growing wave of Irish tech companies that are doing great things these days. Occupop are an ATS. I think they've got ambitions to do lots of different things. But I think right now, if you're a business that is looking for your first ATS and you're still resting around with stuff on spreadsheets or you're trying to do it all by email, God help you, you might want to try something like Occupop. It's a fantastic entry-level tool. And by the way, they have a unique 30-day free trial, which are made exclusive to Brain Food, by the way. So check that out. Just give it a shot for 30 days. See if you like it. If you do, then boom, there's your product. There's your tool. All right. Thanks a lot for Occupop. I will chat to them a bit later. But let's welcome Adam Gordon on screen. Great to see you, Adam. You're looking well. How's life treating you?
Yep. Life treating me really good. Thanks very much for having me back, especially after like, every second week we go onto the subject and you go, this is a subject Adam and I know absolutely nothing about. And I'm like, I spent years doing that exact thing.
I give you no credit.
I just want to say right now, I did work in a recruitment agency in fact, in two stints, for 3 years and then later in a different role for 2 years. So I do understand the subject that we're talking about here because I've also worked in-house.
Did you work in-house? I've never spotted that in your CV.
Well, you haven't. You don't have a clue what I've done.
It's true. I don't pay attention. That's true.
I don't even know how I ever got invited on this. But anyway.
So hang on. Who did you work in-house for? Because I know you were, you last told me you were Norman Broadbent or something. That's all I heard. I was top and tail of your.
Yeah, I was on the operating board of Norman Broadbent. I was divisional managing director of that firm. I was at PwC for 3 years, advising both customers and doing stuff in-house as well.
So PwC was the role where you were recruiting people for PwC, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Very interesting. I'm going to have to do a background check on you because I don't believe you. It's like your own boss. Did Adam actually do this? He said that live that he was your recruitment person.
It's on LinkedIn.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's true.
It doesn't mean anything. That's true.
Anyway. Okay, so let's have a look at the newsletter from last week, man. Did you read it? And if you did, what was interesting?
Yeah, loads of stuff. The ones that I really enjoyed the some things that have got descriptions that are just to capture the imagination, like stop Swiss cheesing your calendar. Absolutely, it's a big problem for me, definitely is. I mean, I'm lucky if I've got 4 30-minute blocks in my diary that aren't full of meetings. And the recommendation in this is really simple. Just work out when you are most effective and block out 4 hours in your calendar where that's where you do your actual work. I mean, I find it really regularly that I get to 5 o'clock and go, God, I've actually got to look at my email now, my LinkedIn messages, my, you know, Slack messages, and I've got to now follow up with all the meetings I've had all day. So that is one of the problems with, I think, working from home is that people do assume you're more available and you are also more like drawn to fill up your diary with as much stuff as possible so that it doesn't feel like
the guilt factor. Absolutely. Yeah. Folks, if this is you, I thoroughly recommend you check out this post because the idea is absolutely solid. It's the concept of if you just have an empty diary and people can pop stuff in there, every meeting you accept will cause, if you like, a cognitive load on your mind. You'll be on your mind thinking about it before you do it, right? I mean, most people, you know, would prepare a little bit for your meeting, or you prepare, oh, who's this? I'm going to talk about it. And it means that you just bleed out your energy, mental energy, when you should be focusing on your work. So the concept of not Swiss cheesing it is to say, look, have a time, regular time in your day where you accept meetings, and then block out time where you don't accept meetings. I actually did something today after rereading this, and that was block out Fridays. Because Fridays is brain food. I prepare for brain food. And it doesn't look like it, but I do prepare for brain food. And it's like, I can't be dealing with having a conversation at you know, an hour before this live stream. I've got to just focus on this. And then after the live stream, there's all kinds of post-production I need to do. So, and distribution, I've got to have that blocked as well. So Fridays, no meetings, not happening. And basically, you can accept, create windows in other parts of your week to do that. So totally recommend you do it. Have a read of the post I've just shared in the chat stream there. Really useful. By the way, quick shout out to the folks watching this on LinkedIn and watching this on Facebook Live as well. By the way, LinkedIn, some really interesting updates there. I don't know whether you saw this, Adam, but LinkedIn is now allowing things called cover stories to happen. So if you get your mobile phone out, you fire up your LinkedIn app, you will be able to record a 30-second to the camera video message that goes onto your profile. And your profile picture will have an orange hoop around it, and it will be clickable, and that 30-second video message will play. Give it a shot now, folks. And I think this would be super useful for anybody in our business. Great for you as to market, for instance, right? You're selling something, right? There's your 30 seconds. You can literally describe what the hell it is you're selling to whoever is clicks on it. And if you're a candidate, it allows you to present yourself there. If you're recruiting candidates and they've got an orange hoop there, you can actually get a bit of sort of information about what they're out and what they're motivated by. by clicking that video. I think it's a really, really important feature. I'm surprised LinkedIn haven't talked about it, but it's out right now. So check it out. If you want, by the way, to figure out what that looks like, just click on my profile with the orange hoop, and I'm saying a few words there. That's basically what it does. But you can do it basically on your mobile device. Okay, cool. Give us a couple more.
Yeah, sure. So one of them is, I was thinking about talking about the option plan tool from Index Ventures, which is pretty useful for, if you're making offers to people to come and work in a startup or a scale-up business, then, you know, the concept of share options is quite complex to explain. So it's a really simple tool to help you show, new hires what they're going to be getting. But I'm not going to talk about that, because what is actually even better, because it includes pretty much the same thing, was this interactive offer letters tool from, I think it's an organization called Figure HR.
Right, yep.
The interactive offer letter is just excellent, because you can go in there and there's like, it's just really engaging. It's colorful, leads you through what your offer looks like, talks to you about what your salary is, gives you calculators for your flexible benefits. So you can put in, okay, I want a bit of this, I want a bit of that. And it shows you how it all, you know, lines up. It shows you for stock options, what is like we have underperformed by 30% versus we've hit our targets versus we smash it out of the park as an organization. You know, what would that it mean in that context? So it almost includes that kind of, you know, options calculator, but it includes everything else as well. Just cool. Very, very great. I think onboarding something that the offer management bit is something that is normally done in a very boring kind of way.
It's a 20-page legal document. I mean, exactly. In the old days, it would be something you would simply not read, because it would be like, oh my goodness, I can't just possibly plow through this. This is you're right, Adam. New tool, new product, and they I love this because they're attacking a problem we might not have realized existed, which was just the bad experience that an offer letter generally is. It's just a text-based document, probably Times New Roman, right? There's no attention paid to how it makes people feel. But here they've just got an interactive thing which allows you to basically explore it as you go. And, you know, of course, relevant for things like stock options, but you can also imagine anybody with doing flexi benefits these days, which are becoming more useful, you know, but people doing credits that they can spend in different places. Well, you can kind of have a look at what this looks like. So really useful product. Do check them out. New tech. Didn't realize it was there, but there we have it.
Really good. I mean, I'm surprised that you don't get that through like applicant tracking systems. It's not that difficult to create. It's just a kind of landing page with some like different blocks, and you just put in the information. It's not that difficult to create.
Like we just referred to earlier, I think it's one of those that people haven't thought about it as a potential problem to solve, and here you needed to see it, and you realize, actually, these boys are onto something. You know, I mean, yep. You can imagine that being something that would, integrate with any ATS. That's probably their angle. And then suddenly you might have a really profitable business doing something that everyone wants, but it's actually quite small, but, you know, I'd like to have everyone does indeed use. So, yep, very good.
I was talking to some people who know quite a lot about recruitment yesterday, 9 of them in this one meeting. And I put forward the point that every single part of recruitment, with the exception of assessment, every single other point is about journey design. It's about communication, and it's about if the candidate does this, then something else should happen. If the hiring manager does this, then something else should happen. And you can automate so much of it. And without, you know, even though you take some of the human out of it, you can add the human into it by, you know, giving engaging experiences. And that's about the thought that's gone into something that's actually quite automated. So, yep. Okay, one more.
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you described it as War for Talent 2.0.
Yeah.
we've talked about this before, so I thought let's add the next one in here in the competition. Barbados and Western Cape are both paying people to go and like live and work there, telecommuting, you know, on a kind of longer term basis. Italy has joined up, and I'm not surprised. It's a good thing for Italy to do. Two specific locations, one's called Santa Fiora and the other one's called Rieti, and they're really amplifying. The food here is delicious. Riding on horseback through the hills is, you know, a wonderful thing to do when you're not, you know, working on your laptop from home. So lots and lots of reasons to go and choose that. I think Scotland should do it as well. Scotland's got so many things to offer, including the weather and whatever. So that would be a good.
I love Scotland, and you know, I'd live there 5 years. I wouldn't say a bad thing about it. But I think they're going to lose out on the weather, man. I mean, there's no way you're going to pitch, hey, come and be rained on for 200 days a year. That's just not happening. Especially when you have options like Italy, which are going to be cheaper as well, right? So Northern Europe, I don't think, wins this. But Italy's obviously suffered from brain drain, talent drain, moribund economy a long time, but it's got some natural qualities that simply unfair competitive advantage, you call it in startup land, right? You're not going to get the weather like this. The weather then produces the amazing food that you can get really easily. The lifestyle on top of that is going to be fantastic. There's just never, you know, the trade-off has always been you weren't getting the economic values in these spots. And even though your lifestyle might be high, you're just not earning a lot of money or any money at all. Like a lot of places, it was barter economy sometimes. Now with remote work from anywhere, okay, why don't you work in South Italy then? You know, check out Sardinia or someplace, place that you'd normally go on holiday and pay good dollars for. You know, instead of spending a week there, why don't you spend 6 months and see whether you can do your job out there? Probably you could do a lot of it. So Italy, I would say anybody with a decent weather, any tourist place has got a huge competitive advantage. They should max out on it, no doubt.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about this topic and bring our guests on here. In fact, your journey is different, Adam, isn't it? Because you didn't go agency. Actually, you did. Agency to in-house. Was that the journey you made or not?
No. It was agency to recruitment marketing agency. So I worked in recruitment, placing newly qualified accountants for 3 years, probably 2 years into that. I didn't really want to hear about another, you know, newly qualified KPMG person telling me that they were ready to be CEO of a FTSE company. So, you know, that's not something I was fed up with hearing that by that point. What I really did enjoy, actually, though, was all the marketing aspects of recruitment. So I went and joined a company that was at the time called Riley Advertising Communications. Today it's called Havas People. So I quite quickly, my career got into employer branding. This is back in 2002, employer branding and recruitment marketing, and then joined PwC 2 years later in 2004. I think the experience in recruitment marketing and employer branding helped with the transition into the in-house environment.
What's the big difference between in-house and agency, like in your view, now that you've gone through a little bit of this and seen it from the inside out?
Recruitment agency world is, you know, you think that you're doing recruitment and you think you know all about recruitment. The honest truth is, you know about 15% of what recruitment is about. Recruitment is massively broader than agency recruitment. Agency recruitment is, there's a role, find the people, everybody else does the rest of the work, you know, and you think you've done the bit of recruitment when you found the people and submitted them. That's not, you haven't done the work at that point. The work gets done like by a million other things that are involved in it, from assessment to controlling your hiring managers to, you know, actually taking all those briefs from the hiring managers and consulting with them and advising on them and choosing the different channels. By the time the recruitment agency's got the brief for the job, that's not necessarily the start of the process. That might be the fifth thing that employer's done, you know, in order to try and get that job filled. So
I can see the way in which you've delivered that is going to annoy a lot of people who might be recruitment agents.
I mean, like, I could write out all the different things you need to do as a recruitment consultant in a recruitment agency, and there's maybe 20 things. I could write out all the things that you need to do as an in-house recruiter, and there's probably 120 things. You can't argue with it.
Hold that thought. I mean, people listening in on this, particularly on LinkedIn, by the way, because I know there's a lot of agency recruiters that are on my network there. Do you think that was a fair assessment of the difference between agency and in-house? And we're not talking about difficulty or anything like that. We're just talking about the scope. So agency is narrower in the sense that you're going to be hyper-focused on delivery on this particular thing, whereas in-house is a wider scope. You've got to do more before and after and during, and therefore less focus. What are your thoughts on that? Let me know in a comment. I'd like to give the agencies kind of a chance to make their case a little bit here.
I'm not criticizing agency work in any way. I'm simply saying the much narrower skill set needed to do that job. And in fact, actually, the recruitment consultant, the agency recruitment consultant job is arguably a very, very broad skill set that's needed to do that. But the activities involved in-house are much, much broader. And the other thing to say about it is that I don't think one is more difficult than the other. They are very... They are both very complex jobs, and you know the pressure on recruitment agency job is something that is you know really intense in a specific thing. You have to have enough customers needing enough of your people, or enough people to you know satisfy the customers, and you've got to balance all of that. The in-house job, there's just you're drinking from the fire. You're probably drinking from the fire hose. You're asked to be an employer branding person a lot of the time, which is an entirely different skill set. You're asked to advise on assessments, which is in a completely different type of thing. So, you know, a lot of in-house teams are not 360 degree recruiters is the wrong way to do it. Anyway, sorry, enough rant, but
No, you're actually getting support. You're getting support on Crowdcast here, which is exciting to see, because you never get support there, do you, mate? I think that from my experience, and folks, I don't know whether this chimes with you, I thought emotionally agency, it was harder because of the pressure of sales, targets, just general hyper competition at desk. And also that then creates pressure to behave in a certain way, which may not necessarily be, you know, how you would normally behave. I was certainly a more sharky as a recruiter, you know, more focused on closing, more pressuring, I would say. I mean, I'm not proud to admit that, but in terms of, you know, candidate control, quote unquote, that kind of thing was a big part of, you know, doing the job. So emotionally, I think it's tougher. But I think you're broadly correct with regards to the wider scope of in-house. You're going to have to do different things more so than the same thing over and over. That was my experience of it.
Alex has made a comment in the chat here and said that agency scope's incredibly narrow, and then has put in brackets GCSE internal is a PhD for sure. And a few other people have agreed with that. And I understand the point in that, but I think that's saying that agency work is kind of more dumbed down, and I don't agree with that. I think they're both about as challenging as each other. It's just that the internal role is just so much broader. And to your point, Hung, about being more sharky as a recruitment agent, I think your job is to get the job filled. Your job is to do the deal. Let's call it do the deal. You're not going to get into shit if the person's not good, because you just need them to start for the first 3 months, and then your fees secured. The in-house person's going to get fired if on month two the hiring manager comes back and goes, everybody you send me doesn't work out.
All right, I'm not sure I agree with that. I would say that in-house you can hide a lot more. Agencies you can't hide. There's another psychological challenge there. Again, folks, I mean, I don't want anybody to kind of admit that they're hiding in their jobs, obviously. But I think if you're in a big organization and you're kind of working behind the scenes on lots of different things, you could argue you are contributing in some way that was very different or not explicit or visible. Whereas an agency, typically, you're operating solo operator at desk, delivering to your own target. If you're not hitting that, you're totally exposed. You're on the damn leaderboard. Do you know what I mean? So I think that that creates a totally different type of pressure. And maybe that's the biggest difference between the two. I mean, again, we're going to get our guests on the second. We'll explore this in a bit more depth. But in my view, the biggest difference between the two was the sense of pressure is different, and the motivation is different. And those two things can kind of make the same person more appropriate for agency versus in-house.
I think it might depend on the culture of the organization, and it might depend on the industry you're in as well. So I see that Nicole has agreed with you and said that in-house is more forgiving. I think what you just said is you can hide more. But the thing is, if you're in a recruitment agency, you get fired if you haven't hit your fee targets. That's true. If you're in-house, you could get fired because either you haven't filled enough jobs or because you filled them with the wrong people. So
let's bring people in to talk about this, because I'm excited to bring on some friends. I want to also explore exactly how you make the transition as well, because I think the world's changed since you and I had to make this type of move, right? So these days, there's much more fluidity between the groups. Let's see how we do. We're going to bring on Sophie to begin with. Sophie Power, I haven't spoken to Sophie for ages, so it'd be great to get her on. Let's see where we can get Robert on as well. Robert Nunn, he's actually recruiting for recruiters at this point. So this should be exciting as well. There he is. Okay, let's hope we get this sorted smoothly.
Hey, hey.
Oh, there she is. How are you doing, Sophie?
Yeah, good, good. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. How wonderful to see you.
Yes, good to see you too. It's been a long time.
I know. I'm ashamed as to how long it might have been. So I don't want to, you know, we'll have to take that offline, you know. And there's Robert. Robert, how are you doing?
Good to see you. I'm all right. Yeah, thanks. And thank you for having me on. Hi, Sophie. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. I think last time I saw you was at the Dragon Bar, actually. So good to see you again.
That was the last DBR drinks before the world went to pot,
yeah. Didn't it?
You know what? I didn't actually realize you two knew each other, and I had this like a sense of worry that there was some sort of horrible history between you two. And I thought, no, I've brought the wrong
love in DBR.
brought the wrong people together. Okay, so for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Sophie, you first. Who are you? What is it you do?
Hey. Yeah. So my name is Sophie Power. I've been working recruitment for about, it's pushing 10 years, but we'll go now. I have worked in agency very briefly in RPO and moved quite quickly into in-house. I was quite lucky in that regard. I also, in the past couple of years, have been working largely in startups as a contract tech and commercial recruiter. And also for the past 2.5 years, have been a community admin for DBR in-house recruitment network.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Go to you, Rob. Who are you and what it is you do?
Yeah, so I'm Robert Nunn. I've 20-something years experience in recruitment and started off in agency, boutique agency, and then did a year at the large corporate Hudson agency, and then went RPO before I came in-house. I am now head of internal talent acquisition at Elements Talent Consultancy.
Fantastic, and that's a super interesting scenario because you're actually recruiting recruiters kind of for in-house. I'm confused as to how exactly to describe your role, but it's involving recruiters moving from one thing to another. So we'll explore that in more depth, Rob. Let's talk about by the way, LinkedIn's just shared in those two in the chat stream there. So let's talk about this topic, like the big difference between agency in-house. You heard, you know, our views earlier there about maybe it's an emotional difference.
I was itching to get on, to be fair.
Yeah, Adam was talking about skill set difference or scope, you know. I'll go to you first with this, Sophie. Your experience on this, personal experience, you don't need to be an expert on it, your own view as you made this transition, difference between agency and in-house, how would you crystallize it?
Sure. So I felt much better suited to in-house recruitment than agency recruitment, it's fair to say. I was more than happy to get on the phone and make 80 to 100 cold calls a day, but I hated it. What I found when I moved in-house is that I could utilize a lot more of the skills that I'm just so much better at, like building the longer term relationships, offering more personal experience to candidates, and sort of building better relationships with my stakeholders. I felt that sort of the aim of my role was about the playing the long game rather than sort of the quick wins and kind of hitting targets and moving on. Yeah, I just so much preferred that to sort of my role in agency. So yeah, I felt much better suited to it. And I kind of, when I started in agency, I had that inclination that that would probably be the case. So I don't know whether it's a little bit of, I had in my mind that I wanted to move in-house. So it, maybe, I don't know, maybe sort of having that in my mind meant that perhaps I always sort of had my eye on the door and maybe that didn't help, but I don't know if I sort of created a self-fulfilling prophecy there, but yeah, I much prefer being in-house. What I found from talking to friends of mine, so friends from university, friends from school, who I've known sort of outside of work, Sophie Brain, she is in there somewhere, is, you know, sort of when they've gone from agency to in-house, one comment they've made that I also found the same was it's really interesting actually having a seat at the table, sitting at the table and people actually wanting your opinion on things. That's one thing I found, because nobody was questioning, well, you would say that because you're looking for a fee. And I think, you know, that was the first thing all of my sort of non-DBR recruitment mates who happened to work in agency said when they moved over. They said it was really strange. I expressed an opinion and it got listened to. I did like sort of having that stakeholder relationship and being to build that. And I love, you know, sort of I work in startups, so I'm very fortunate in that I get to work really closely with you know, sort of co-founders, CEOs, COOs, there we go, breathe Sophie, I talk way too fast, and yeah, I really enjoy sort of having and being able to interact. As an agency recruiter, I would be filtering CVs and just interacting with, you know, sort of the person who's the HR person in-house, maybe the hiring manager directly. And I wouldn't get the insights I do that help me sort of be more nuanced when I'm sourcing for candidates. It sort of felt a little bit like I'd send CVs over and hope that I was on the money. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And in fact, I think that's probably everyone would agree with that, in the sense that I think an in-house person will have deeper knowledge of the business they're working in-house at. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. No one would dispute this. Maybe the agent would have more market knowledge, let's say. If they're specializing in a particular vertical, they were speaking to multiple companies, they'll have the market knowledge, but not individual company knowledge. So I think that's absolutely spot on. You raised a bunch of stuff there, which I want to jump back into, Sophie. But let's talk to Rob with his opinion on, try and crystallize it for us, Rob. Like, what is the difference in your personal experience working agency to in-house? What was the big things you needed to change to succeed in one or the other?
Sure. So, I mean, with the discussion you were having before I joined, I was sort of more erring more towards Adam's point of view. It's a different pressure. It's a different skill set, I suppose. I mean, my motivations were that I valued the quality over the quantity.
Yeah.
I wanted to move away from the transactional element, and you know, I lasted 7 years in agency, but I was never motivated by revenue. I was motivated by having strong relationships with my clients and doing more value add for them. And it was the lack of control over the end-to-end process and competing with other agencies and, you know, random things that I was delivering a lot to legal firms and financial services in the city and, you know, in IT. And people were turning up with no ties or Mickey Mouse ties. And, oh, you know, I'm losing out for silly things and not having that full control from end to end. And Adam talked about the journey design, and that's a massive part of what the in-house role is, and it full end to end. You know, I've always used agencies in a bit part in all of my in-house roles, and they are worth their weight in gold. You know, when the spike in hiring goes up, or you can't quite find the right person, but I've always treated them as an extension to the in-house team. You know, brought them in, valued their expertise, made, you know, given them access to hiring managers, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the full sort of end-to-end control and the different elements of what recruitment is that I was interested in, not just that little sourcing, finding, submitting, getting them through the interview in the first 3 months of their probation and getting the fee and
moving
on.
I think that's broadly fair. If you did list the things as Anthem did, 20 things versus 120 things, maybe an exaggeration, let's say, but probably true in the sense that the job is just narrower, more companies doing the same thing for more companies. It's basically what agencies are doing. That's how you make your most money anyway. I mean, if you were smart, you would have, you'd optimize for a market that was very good for agency work, and you would deliver to as many customers that needed your service as possible. But it ultimately means you're not trying to diversify your way around. You're recruiting for all kinds of different jobs, all kinds of different companies. That's actually a route for failure for agencies, I think, for an agent, let's say. Well,
that's certainly how we were set up when my first agency. It was, there's a bunch of clients on the CRM system. We're doing IT infrastructure, go and sell to them. And it was, okay, all right. So is it legal? Is it finance? Is it broadcasting? Is it media? What do you want me to do? And, it was sort of, there wasn't really any expertise in what I was doing.
Mm. Yeah, different kind of skill set. Go ahead, Adam, you're saying.
You don't really get external recruitment, recruitment agencies that are where the consultant is like, yeah, I do everything. I'll hire your receptionist and your marketing manager. And, that just doesn't happen. It probably did in the like 90s. You got people who did that, but they have, this is where the narrow thing comes from. They have a deep area of expertise, and it is often those areas that companies don't hire that regularly for. So like, there's not many companies that are always hiring treasury managers. So, the treasury manager is something that a company was going to hire once every 12 months or something like that. And so it's very infrequent, and therefore it's just much harder for the internal person to go and hire that individual. Whereas if they're constantly hiring auditors, they can build up pipelines and they can make it more sustainable for themselves. There's a guy, just as an example, a guy I know who's very successful recruitment consultant, and he hires fire specialists for engineering companies. That's not an area I've even really thought about much until I met him. And that you're naturally a bit more of a, not a jack of all trades, but you have to, in the in-house environment, have a broad, you're doing lots of different things. Every day's different.
Yeah, you can't be an expert, like a narrow expert. Otherwise, unless you're in a big internal team where that can afford to have someone focusing on this, then that's a different story. But most in-house teams, I think, are quite small. I mean, especially when you go in, let's say, startup level, but usually first person in, let's say you're recruiting everybody. And even the median size of an in-house department, I think, is probably 2 or 3 people. Before you get to the mega businesses that obviously have entire units. But most companies up to about 200 odd, so they're probably manage it with 4 or 5 people, I reckon, as an internal recruiting team. So it's small, and therefore that those people are going to recruit different types of roles throughout the business. Okay, let's talk about what is the skills required to transition if that's something you wanted to do? So part of the reason I was inspired to do this show is because I was getting a lot of questions at me saying, Hong, I want to move in-house. How do I do that? And I realized that I didn't have advice to give, because it's been such a long time since I made that move myself that it was potentially out of date. So keen to know what your thoughts are on this one. Agency recruiter, 5-10 years, let's say, wants to have a shot in-house. What is the practical ways to do that? Is it something they can do?
Yeah, should I tell that? Yeah, 100%. I think it's somewhere between 30 and 40% of the people we do hire at Elements come from the agency side.
Direct from agency.
Direct from agency, yeah. And what does stand out is people that, are clear on their motivations for moving across. But people who are forever curious and are not necessarily experts in their domain, but understand it completely and beyond the buzzwords, and will have immersed themselves in their speciality, whether it be software engineering, whether it be back end, front end, or sales marketing, whatever it may be, but know what the impact of a software engineer has on a business, and will understand what it means to be a software engineer in a big company and really add value to their domain strengths. An interview that I was part of, I'm only 10 weeks at Elements, so I've been sitting in on a load of interviews, And a guy that really stood out, I won't name his name to embarrass him, but he was, his specialty was data science and AI. And he had immersed himself in that subject. And he was, you know, speaking with local universities and lecturers and understanding, reading research papers and, you know, part of that community and adding value to candidates in that community. And he, you know, he wasn't a data engineer or a data scientist, but he could certainly hold decent conversations and add value to the companies he was delivering to based on that element of learning that he invested his time in. So, you know, be able to show that is a clear.
How does that chime with the person needing to be flexible though, Rob? Because let's say you're hiring for, like one of the things we talked about just earlier, maybe elements here are slightly different in a sense you're putting people on site or back in the day on site, I guess. Who knows how that's going to play out sort of in the pandemic era, shall we say. But would it be fair to say someone who's like hyper-focused like this, is that going to be in tension with the idea, okay, I'm recruiting this person in to do, you know, he or she could be hiring an office manager or...
No, I mean, well, you know, they've obviously shown that they can do that and they can and they are willing to learn their subject matter, you know, and once they've done that, they can explore different areas. And that, I suppose, is one of the benefits of coming in-house and coming to an embedded model like Elements is that there is that opportunity to expand that domain knowledge. But it's that being that forever curious mentality for always wanting to learn and always wanting to explore and delve below the surface and the buzzwords of what recruiting is.
What tell me about the people that don't make it. So you get a bunch of candidates coming through the process. How do you decide on CV, for instance, or do you decide on CV? How do you decide on interview? What is the thing that tells you that's a potential person that could make that transition or that's a person that is not suitable? Can you give us some rules of thumb with that, Rob?
Sure. So, I mean, there isn't really a rule of thumb on looking on CVs or LinkedIn profiles, but, you know, the team get to know what agencies are good. You know, you can look online and see what roles they're advertising. And, you know, we look at sort of really about three years minimum experience really to have gained that. But where people do fall down is that they don't have that depth of knowledge. And the team that I manage are do delve into their experience, you know, because a lot of people know the buzzwords. Okay, what does that actually mean? What's the impact of that? What's the impact of their role with the bigger ecosystem? And, you know, and it just they want to ask and understand the real depth of someone's knowledge. And if it's just surface level, that's you can find that out fairly quickly. And you know, someone it's not necessarily the higher billers from agencies or you know the top performers. But someone who is that curiosity and does really know their domain, that it does come across fairly quickly in the interview.
That's a really interesting idea. Like maybe the very top performers at agency level may not be suitable for in-house for a variety of reasons.
If you're a top biller, you're earning lots of money and your career's going stellar and that's what's motivating you, so you're going to stay. So
well, you're also probably very, very single focused on what you're doing. And you may well have a slightly different personality set from the talent acquisition personality where you need to be very, very collaborative and bring together lots of people. And if you're the highest billing salespeople are often not got quite that personality. They're very, you know, single focus blinker.
All right. That's a really interesting thing. I want people to comment on this. Oftentimes in-house is perceived you haven't made it as a recruiter, therefore you've got in-house the soft touch type of approach. And this is actually one of the core problems, I think, antagonism in-house and agency still has this idea. But what if there's an element of truth to it, to a degree, in the sense that the absolute elite agencies or agents are earning so well and doing absolutely so much, there's no way they would ever go in-house because you simply, the earning power is so significantly lucrative as agency. And the only people that do make the transition and should make the transition are good recruiters that perhaps haven't hit that top level for whatever reason. I would actually count myself as one of those folks, by the way. I was Yeah, I was a good recruiter, no doubt. I'd hire myself again, I think. but I wouldn't say, oh, I've got hung, I'm going to now completely sort the, you know, the billings are sorted for the year. No, you know, it would still be a dude you need to kind of look after. So so maybe that's the thing. Sophie, you still with us, yeah?
Yeah, trying. I'm really sorry. I've phoned up my internet provider. Apparently, it's the weather.
It is. Don't worry about it. If you can still hear, that's fine.
I've had this issue. No, it's just such an interesting point about that Rob made about the, you know, sort of top biller. Oh, I'm just going to say, I'm a recruiter. Absolutely rubbish. What matters, billing, making money. But I've had a really successful, sustainable career as an in-house recruiter, and I like to think I'm very good at it. And I just think, yeah, it's such an interesting point that, you know, the skills that maybe make you a really good agency recruiter don't always be, you know, don't always translate into what makes you a good in-house recruiter. And I think, absolutely, as well as that curiosity, it's really important. I think some of the things that make you really good in a sales career, that kind of bolshy, sort of, you know, kind of scrappy mentality, there's useful elements to pull from that, but I don't think it necessarily would translate into a stakeholder meeting. I think one of the other things as well, like I speak to, I don't often recruit recruiters. It's one of the roles that I think I've maybe recruited once or twice in my career, and I have recruited all sorts of roles. But I have often spoken to agency recruiters. Perhaps I've been a client of theirs for a number of years, and they are thinking about moving in-house. So they often will reach out to me, buy me a gin and tonic, a coffee, and ask me about, you know, I'm interviewing with this, with one of my clients. I'm really excited. You know, what do I need to do? What do I need to think about? And I think the ones that, I think the agency recruiters that are more focused on their long-term relationships with their clients than just that first hire in and by any means necessary, they're the ones that I have seen go into in-house recruitment and absolutely smash it, and I love to see it. I've worked with a couple of really brilliant agency recruiters. I've almost been a little bit sad when they've moved in-house, because then I can't use them anymore.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh great, now I've got to go and find another new sales agency recruiter. Great. Happy for you though.
You know what, on that note, very quickly, think that sense of stakeholder management is very, very important. Also part of the annoyance a lot of agencies have, because obviously as an agent, you manage loads of stakeholders as well. But I think it's a different kind of stakeholder management. I think that's where there's a little bit of we're talking past each other somewhat, in the sense that as an agent, you tend to have an opportunity to choose your clients. And in fact, that's what you should be doing. You shouldn't just be accepting any job that comes your way. If your stakeholder is clearly not a person that is respecting your service, don't work with that person. You can 100%. Exit. But if you're sitting internally and that person happens to be your CTO, you can't down tools.
There's
only choices to walk out from the business. So, there's a different level of tolerance for bad stakeholders, if you like, or tough stakeholders, and therefore requiring to do more 100%. Effort there.
Yeah, there is no running away from a role in-house. It's another thing that some of my mates who've made the move have said, and they kind of one or two of them were like, look, I didn't even think about it. But actually, no matter how long it takes you, no matter how much by the end of the process you just hate that role and want it done, you still have to fill it. There is no running away. And there's been a couple of roles in my career where I've got to the finish line and it's taken me, you know, maybe 6 months to fill a really niche technical role usually. And I've just gone, hallelujah. Whereas I know, because I've tried to use agencies for help, they've sort of got bored and moved on after a month. And I don't blame them. It has surprised a few of my friends who've moved in house, actually.
Moving on quickly, because we're running out of time, folks, and we've got to get Tim and Laura onto this. What is the one big difference, and not about, you know, the difficulties, but is there like one thing you would recommend for a agent that's just become in-house first time and they've asked you for that coffee, actually, so they've moved on and said, Sophie, I got the job. What's the one thing you could advise them to do in order to make their success faster as an in-house person versus agency? So question to both of you, but Sophie, you first.
Sure. I would highly recommend that you ask lots of questions about the business, meet as many people as you possibly can. When you start, get to know the business as well as humanly possible, because that is going to be your best tool for success. I would also recommend trusting yourself. You might not know how to be an in-house recruiter, but you do, you've been offered this job, they've hired you, they've seen something in you, and you know your market that you've been operating in. Like Rob said, usually agency recruiters are highly specialized in their market, and ultimately that a lot of that is what you will have been hired for. So trust in that and have faith that you do actually know what you're doing. And the, you know, sort of the internal quirks will come, but just be willing to ask questions and learn.
Yep, that's absolutely agree with that, those points, Sophie. Go ahead, Rob. What would you advise?
So I agree with everything Sophie said there. In addition, I think it to get rid of this the hiring managers are always right mentality. You know, you're there to advise, and you know, an agency, you sort of almost not bow to them, but you know, your hiring manager is your point of contact, and their yes and no is everything. But internally, it's up to you to manage the process and advise and consult and you know, maybe persuade a little bit more than you would as an agent, but you know, get ready to do that. But yeah, very much get to know the business, get to know the structures, get to know what the business finds, what looks good for that business and what the hiring manager wants.
Yeah, it's a different type of influence, isn't it? Whereas from when you're working agency, your influence really is at to close the deal, to get the requisition, to do all of those things. But when you're in-house, your job is you're going to get the job, right? So you don't have to acquire it. What you have to do is influence and kind of manage that process to optimize your ability to deliver against it. Slightly further down the pipe, I think, in terms of how it all works. Okay, cool. We have to move on, folks. So thank you, Sophie and Rob. Great to have you on. Please hang around with us. We're going to keep talking in the chat stream.
Yeah,
we need to move on quick to bring on Robert and Tim. Okay, good. Great to see you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Cool cats, eh? Very cool cats. I thought some really interesting examples as well in terms of the thinking and mindset. I'm tracking what people are saying on LinkedIn as well. Thank you for your comments there. Really fair points. And I hope you kind of can get the vibe. I think the jobs are similar. Same people might be able to do it, but maybe not all the same people. So it's a big Venn diagram. But there's a bunch of people I think could be great agents, but never you would see in-house. Vice versa, also the same. Great in-house folks that, you know, they are people who have failed in agency, let's say, or would fail if you had to get them in that situation.
If somebody's failed in a recruitment agency, I think it's quite likely they would fail in an in-house environment as well. If you can't recruit.
Okay.
If you're a mid-level performer in a recruitment agency, you could be a high-level performer in an in-house environment, but if you're an actual failure in a recruitment agency, you're probably going to be a failure in-house as well, in my opinion.
That's a strong comment. I think most people would agree with you because they don't want to have the badge of failure attached to them. Although I think Sophie came close to saying she was, which we are very brave of her to do that. But you know what? I just want to say one thing real quick. I'm really pleased to see these two folks on screen because these are my former colleagues. Would you believe it? I worked agency side with both Tim Smith and Laura Callahan back in the day. These were two of the senior recruiters, recruitment managers when I was like a baby recruiter coming into the business. So I'm really pleased to see them both on Brain Food Live on air. It's awesome. Laura, quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do.
Hey, thanks ever so much for inviting me to join today. So really pleased to be here. Laura Callahan, I've got about 20 years of recruitment experience, about 10 of those in agency recruitment, and during that time kind of moved towards larger scale delivery. So for me, there was a transition then to the RPO side, so companies like Thomson Reuters, PwC, Capgemini on the tech piece, before I made that move, which took me longer than I had planned, over to internal, to an internal role. So working for Save the Children, Western Union. So more kind of larger scale delivery, kind of that larger permanent piece maybe, than some of your, than your two earlier guests.
Yeah, fantastic. That'd be great to get your views on this. So Tim, quickly, for the people who don't know you, by the way, lovely hair. For the people who don't know you, who are you, what it is you do, sir?
Hi everyone, I'm Tim Smith. I'm the head of talent at ClearScore. I've been in-house now for 5 years, and before that had 10 years of my own agency, and before that working with Laura Hung and others.
Back in the day. Okay, well, listen, we're talking about this transition. We've all made it. Let's talk about the qualities required for a successful transition to an in-house role. Or is it down to that? I mean, could it be anybody could do it? Anybody could be trained to do it? Or are there qualities about a person that would make this individual very suited to in-house work?
Well, I was listening to obviously some of the conversation that we talked about earlier on, and sort of thinking about Adam's point where he talked about, you know, an agency recruiter capturing that sort of 50%. And for me, it's the kind of top and tail onto the role as the kind of in-house or RPO role expands. And so I've been lucky enough to be able to be quite flexible when I've hired recruiters to either come to an RPO or internally. So I've always been more than happy because of some of the qualities you see in agency recruiters. So for me, it's often that, you know, people come on site or into an internal role thinking you're going to recruit, but actually it's a lot about process that sits behind that. And I think that's often where it can be quite hard. You come in thinking you're going to recruit, but there's all these forms and there's all this paperwork that you have to do, and that's often the kind of start of the process, picking the role up. And as we talked about, it's that managing the hiring manager's expectation on a role. You know, there's the piece in the middle where you do the sourcing, but then at the end you've got all of that, you know, managing the offer, the paperwork behind that. And I think for me, that's often the piece I'll talk quite openly when someone's making that looking to make that transition from an agency, is that there's so much admin and policy and paperwork that you're going to have to get your head around. And I think that's where I've seen at times the challenge for people making that move. You don't have much time to pick that up, to hit the ground running.
It could be that's also a feature of the size and scale of the businesses you're talking about as well, Laura, which makes it a very interesting thing. So if you are recruiting for an agent straight into an in-house role, maybe that's okay if you're a small business or a startup, but it's less okay if you're a bigger business with all of this administrative load that this person inevitably has to wrestle with. It's just a very different type of job. Tim, you're about to say something?
Yeah, I think it's about the sort of personal motivations of the individual. I think for me, it was always about wanting to make an impact. And I think you do make a great impact as an agency recruiter when you deliver an amazing hire, but you don't really see the outcome of that hire. You don't see that individual really living and breathing in the organization, and to the extent that you can then really say that that person was a successful hire for that organization. So I really feel the people that I'm considering in-house should be really motivated by that long-term contribution that they can make to a business. But that contribution then comes in loads of different ways, because I think the best in-house people are process driven and motivated to improve the process. I think I've gone through two experiences of in-house. One was where I started up the internal function, and then at ClearScore where I inherited an already established function. But it's always about deliver, because your credibility comes by the people you hire. But then it's the improvements you make to allow that delivery to be more efficient. And then as you then build up that credibility of your stakeholders, you can then start to look more strategic and start influence things like org design, workforce planning, culture. And that's really when you start getting to really meaty things that I think motivate me, someone with 25 years work experience or recruitment experience. You want to get into the more meaty things that are going to have a massive impact on that, in my case, scale up businesses. I think it might be different for maybe the world, if you're joining a PwC or a massive corporate, then your ability to make that impact might be slightly different. But in my experience, I've enjoyed seeing the outcomes of the labour.
That's a really interesting insight, Tim, particularly with the escalating impact or influence that you have as the department grows. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I noticed in, I think, my first startup job was as I recruited more people, I became more important in the business because suddenly these people I recruited were themselves moving into senior roles. And it was like they were asking me for stuff that I didn't think I was qualified to speculate on. But it became evident that my tenure in that company and sort of by being responsible for bringing these leadership people in, you inevitably increase your influence. And that may be something is not the same agency-wise or other.
I also really agree with what Tim just said, because I think in an in-house environment, you get to see the impact of the work that you've done, whereas in an agency, the impact of the work you've done really stops at the point that the person says, yes, I'm going to take the job. And then there's not an awful lot after that. Whereas I think it's just a more, it can be slightly more fulfilling when you've got the scenario that Hung just described, in that you're making an impact on the business and you can watch that happening in real time.
And I think you see, that piece around kind of improving that, almost like that business partnering piece, is the difference, isn't it, between being an internal recruiter and that value that you add when you you fix problems and you improve the service that you deliver. And I think you see that in the kind of the larger scale delivery. You know, what does that look like and how do you really differentiate yourself as an in-house recruiter? I think you see it in the bigger accounts as well. I still think there's that opportunity there.
One thing I wanted to say as well to people considering the in-house, and I think it's different in the larger organizations, but in a smaller scale-up world, for me, it was like I had to get my mindset out of, as an internal recruiter, if I go to recruitment agencies to support me in my delivery, I failed in some way. Now, I'm sure in the bigger environments, there's a more mature consideration of a broad solutions, and of which agencies always play a part. But I always felt that, how am I adding value as an internal recruiter if I then have to go to an external recruiter? And I've luckily got out of that mindset and now look at it in a much more solutions way. But I want everyone who's thinking about going in-house to look at that you're solving business problems, as Laura says, and you've got a whole suite of options to use. And that's really what makes it exciting, because you can really start to trial and error and really try different things and then ultimately then find a solution that works for that particular business or that particular role.
That's a really interesting insight. And when you said that, Tim, it actually reminded me very much of one of the very first mistakes, was this sense of I can't use third-party agents. They've hired me in-house. You know, I'm meant to do this. For the people who've moved in-house, is that an experience you've shared, where you've got this job? Oh, great. Was your first thing like an aversion to using recruitment agencies because you felt the responsibility to own all of recruiting and actually be the person delivering it all, and therefore failing to do so because you need to have agency support in the right places?
I mean, that's an objective that you know all about before day one, surely. I mean, when you're going through an interview process, you're going to understand, is my objective here cost avoidance or is my objective something different? And of course, if it's cost avoidance, then your task is to fill every job yourself. And in some organizations, you've probably got a target which is 100% direct sourcing, and in others, your job, there's lots of internal recruiters whose job is managing panels of agencies.
Perhaps that's something to argue against, though. Like if you got the job and your brief was to completely eliminate agencies, maybe that's something you need to think deeply about, because is that, you know, is the entire purpose of that business or that job existing simply to reduce cost, or do they actually want to optimize recruiting? Those two things are not necessarily the same things. Because, you know, earlier example, you're hiring lots of different jobs that maybe it makes no sense to do direct sourcing on. And if you're hiring for a CFO, I guarantee you, you don't want to do direct sourcing for that, because you're only going to hire that one time. You know, why would you ever put time and energy building a network to hire that one role? You need to spend your time hiring these evergreen roles. A big difference there.
Hang on, I was just thinking as well, you know, it kind of, if you, you know, I think as you're making that transition, it's a really important point there. You've got to remember that you've got to find the right role for you, haven't you? So even if it feels like a really difficult task to make that transition, you know, as you said, how realistic are some of those things that you're going to be asked to do? Don't be afraid to say that's not the right company to join, because you've got, you know, in the same way they've got to find that, you know, I know this is obvious stuff, but you've got, as much as that company's got to find the right person for them, if what you're going to be set to actually deliver is just unrealistic, you know, make sure that, you know, try and hold your nerve and wait out for the role that does feel like it fits for you.
Can we go to some straight talking on this other point? I want to just make sure we get in. Is it realistic for an agency recruiter without any in-house experience to apply for and get an in-house job? Because I'm getting a lot of frustrated people coming to me and saying, look, I'm just getting bombed out because I don't have this experience. Yeah. And I'm tempted to say the wrong thing to do is to advise them, yeah, keep going, because maybe that's inaccurate. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think choose the organization you're applying to carefully. I think I mentioned in the chat earlier that I think RPO is a good transition where you can take your vertical market experience into a organization that will then give you the exposure to an in-house role, albeit on a temporary basis, and that will be an interesting way of exploring it for you. The other opportunity is finding an organization that's got a talent team large enough where they're still looking at vertical market specialisms. And then again, you get to then really start with credibility based on your knowledge of that marketplace, and then expand your awareness of either other markets or into more project-based work. So I think that's the key thing. Choose the role appropriately, because I do think that marketplace experience is a really valuable commodity.
Okay, folks, Tim, let me just say this real quick, Adam. There's two things that Tim said. I'm going to add a third, which I think can really help agents that want to go in-house. Number one, identify RPOs. That may be your best way to do it, because they are inherently agencies. Most RPOs come from agency staffing models, so they are very used to this. Go into one of those businesses. Maybe they're more receptive to someone who hasn't got this experience but might have the inclination and skill set. Number two, look for bigger organizations that carry a larger TA department where vertical specialisms do exist. And sometimes they operate as almost mini agencies internally, right? So you might get a better chance in there. Third thing I'd say is obviously your existing clients. Like if you have a customer that you're delivering brilliant service to over a period of time, probably transitioning across that way is another way that would be obvious to do. Any others, folks? Any other things?
I think expanding on that last point as well, Hung, it's the existing customers that you've got. But, you know, as a recruiter, you'll have worked with loads of people that probably have gone in-house. You know, you'll have had customers from the past that have moved around. Don't be afraid to use those networks, you know, or even if it's on the kind of, you know, on the back of asking for advice, you know, that's where those relationships, I think, will really help you. So I kind of expand that piece further as well and really go back and look at who you've worked with previously and how they've made that move.
Yeah, and to Rob's point there, he's obviously from Elements, but there's loads of companies of this type now emerging, which are these embedded recruiter type models doing scale-ups. They typically have hired agency first. That they've, I think, almost like a mini RPO. I know they don't like that term, but the RPOs traditionally have been big enterprises. These are more like, hey, you know, they're prepared to work with scale-up businesses. Maybe there's a better angle for you to get into. Any more thoughts on this, Adam?
Yeah, I just wanted to say about the RPO thing. I've been doing a series of interviews with RL100 members recently and about their careers, and two-thirds of them, I think, went agency RPO in-house. They you know, had that step.
Yep.
But the other thing, in terms of a practical recommendation, If you're finding it difficult to get an interview or to get offered the job in-house, and that's what you really want to do, go and find a local not-for-profit in your town or your city and go and do some pro bono work for them. Go and fill some of their jobs and get the testimonial from their, you know, HR director and add it to your LinkedIn profile.
That's a smart move.
I have to say that's how I took a lateral move over to Save the Children, because they were just a bit more flexible in terms of that, you know, what they were looking for, because I really struggled to make that transition, because I'd probably stayed in RPO for just a bit too long by then.
That's I didn't know that of your career there, Laura, but that's a really interesting, and I think Ian said the same thing. It's like, you've got to be prepared with the salary cut. You know, if you've worked 10 years agency-wise, presumably you've had a degree of success, you may not directly translate that number in terms of your take-home pay to an in-house job in your first go. It might take a little bit of a step down before you're able to build back up again. And I would also say probably you'd never hit the optimal peaks of agency earnings. I mean, you can earn a huge amount of money being a recruitment agent. Probably you don't do that in RPO or in-house. That's just simply, again, on your motivations there.
When I was 24, I earned, you know, X amount.
Just say the number.
It was probably about 60 grand or something like that.
Yeah.
And then when I moved out of being a recruitment consultant into the recruitment marketing agency, then in-house, it took me until I was 30 years old to be earning as much as I had done when I was 24.
Yeah.
So I left agency recruitment at 25, and then it took me 5 years to get back to earning what I had been in terms of take-home pay, in terms of basic salary. When you expect your basic salary to go up, you should.
Yeah, and the sort of payment models are different, of course, because the obviously you might be earning good money as a recruitment agent through a commission model, but obviously your base salary would be lower. And often the case is the base salaries in internal roles might even be higher than your base, but of course your take-home pay is going to be less. But then there are some really strong offers out there in terms of opportunities where people are getting good base salaries, they're getting bonuses, they're getting stock options or stock, and also all the benefits. And that comes with a lot of, I think, to a certain extent, some job security there in terms of salary expectations and pay. So I don't think people should look at the pay cut in isolation, because what you might be compromising in pay, you're going to gain in long-term experience. And as you progress through the in-house model, I think at the senior level, there's some really, really good packages out there.
Yeah, and you're potentially now with things like your CPO, head of TA, CHRO type of roles. These are big hitting jobs that will probably earn an equivalent number to a top billing salesperson. You've just reminded me, Adam, about payslips. I reckon, and I'm now ancient, right? And it's been 10 years since I've worked in agency, at least 10 years. But I think my highest ever paycheck ever is probably still agency. So there was like one amazing year I had, fluked it, I have to say, but it was fluked it in such a way, but it was like ridiculous. And I don't think I've ever beaten it. But anyway, I discovered by doing that, by the way, that I wasn't necessarily money motivated, which is why I decided to leave. Because yeah, it was like whatever. Anyway, we're coming to the end of the show, folks. So let's leave it to a final word on this. You're looking to give advice to a recruiter who's got that job. So agency, he or she has actually got an in-house job for the first time. What's your takeaway advice for that person in order for them to get better faster? Laura, go to you.
Two bits for me. Find the person who is best at running the end-to-end process. So systems, how things work, because if you've got that specialist bit in the middle, you'll hit the ground running quicker in a bigger setup. I think, you know, just from my experience, if you can do that, if you can get that grip as quickly as possible on how it works, obviously start the process, you need to know quicker than the end. And also in my experience as well, it's that enabling function that help you, you know, the network, you know, you're going to build your hiring manager, you know, network naturally, but it's who helps you get things done? Who do you need to know to process an offer? Who do you need to know is going to give you advice on, you know, when you're putting a salary together? I mean, obviously that's again sort of larger scale, but if you're looking to make that transition for into a larger scale delivery model, they're the two bits for me that I think are really key to get up and running.
Super relevant, Laura, especially this understanding that a big company is a beast. It's a bureaucratic beast. You need to learn the bureaucracy. Otherwise, you're going to get nowhere. Okay, go to you, Tim.
I would say that the best thing someone can do when they're in an early role is, in addition to what Laura's already said, is plan and prioritize. You know, your time management is so, so critical, and people will want a piece of you all the time. So plan and prioritize is absolutely key. And then the second thing would be over communicate, because what you want to ensure doesn't happen is that one of your key stakeholders is saying, what's going on with that role? Why haven't we hired it yet? And that the only reason they're asking that question is because as the internal recruiter or the internal talent team, you haven't communicated your progress. And if people say this is going to be a real difficult hire, it's going to take us 6 months, then that sets you up nicely to say, right, I'm now going to keep you informed along the process. So I'd say plan, prioritize, and communicate.
That's brilliant. Tim Smith, Roberts, thank you very much. Oh, go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I just want to add one, which is really an application of what Sophie said earlier, and that is get to know the business as well as you possibly can, because there will be a lot of intricacies that you don't necessarily see from the outside that you'll get in terms of get to know every hiring manager you're working with, get to know what their OKRs are, what's going to make them successful, and position yourself as somebody, as a business partner, whose job is to help them be successful.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, folks, that's it for the end of the show. I've overrun a little bit. I just want to thank everyone for joining us. Sophie and Rob earlier, and Laura and Tim just now. Great to have you on the show, folks. Have a very good weekend to you.
Thank you.
Great to see those two. I used to work with them, by the way. They were much better than me. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. That was awesome. Everyone, thank you so much for watching Brain Food Live on Air. If you enjoyed the show, please join us. Follow the channel for more. By the way, as you might have been aware of, I'm going to be out of the UK for the next several weeks. However, Brain Food Live will continue as normal. I'll simply be doing it on the evening, so the backdrop will be changed. However, next week is a big shift, because next week we're not going to do it on Friday. We're going to do it on Thursday. And Adam, you're not invited for this. Well, you are, but it's like one of those where we're going to do it in a ridiculous time for normal, because we're going to do it Middle Eastern time. The topic is recruiting challenges in the Middle East and North Africa. So we're going to speak to folks in Dubai. What are their problems, their hiring priorities, how are they going to do it? And we've got some wonderful guests there. So make sure you join us for that. Okay, that's about it. Have a good weekend, everybody. Hey, that was it. That was quite interesting, wasn't it, Adam?
That was good. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed everybody's perspectives. It's a subject I find really interesting. And it was good. John Blake's posted a job opportunity, by the way, in the chat. It's open for agency recruiter to move to Gibraltar with the gaming company Enting.
All right. Well, if that's the case, John, you want to post it actually on the This Week in Recruiting post I put in, because that can put it into that for next week. So that's probably where it will get the biggest distribution. So go to my profile and my posts. There will be This Week in Recruiting, Blue Book, Blue Cover. Go into that and shove that link in there. Very interesting. Anyway, that's about it, man. I hope. Oh, what do you think of Wilder Fury, man? I mean, typical, really, isn't it? Have you heard?
Yeah, I mean, what? So that what I haven't heard is the update. Is Wilder going to take some step aside money or
no? He's demanded it, but Fury's not going to give it to him. So
yeah, because it's like 20 million he asked for, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, Fury should just give it to him. Fighting Wilder against pointless.
It is totally pointless. But Fury's not going to do it. He's going to fight him again, and it's going to be terrible.
That means Usyk's fighting AJ, which means that, unfortunately, our guy in London's not going to get his chance, Joe Joyce.
Joe Joyce.
He's not, Yeah,
it's a bit, the entire thing is disappointing, isn't it? Because you don't want to see Wilder Fury 3, that no one's interested in that. But there we go. Anyway, so we'll talk about sports another time. I will see you at some other time, Adam. I'm on a flight tomorrow, so I will. Well, thanks for everything you're doing. We'll catch up during the week when I'm over there. Yeah.
All the best.
All right. See you later.